In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents.
Donald Trump was a stain on our country.
I'm someone's daughter, too.
That's what I'm saying!
So help me God. Congratulations, Mr. President.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
Hello, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast, where C-SPAN meets the group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. Elise is probably going to be joining us shortly. She is getting vaxxed. She's getting jabbed. As you can imagine, it is not a seamless process in this here city quite yet. So we'll see, but we're thrilled that she is getting inoculated, of course. And you got, we were just talking, you got yours too. I think me and Sammy are the lone holdouts. We're not holding out, to be clear.
Like, you'd be like, yes, please immediately, like, poke me. Poke me. It's very exciting. New York is switching to 30 and over as of today. You can get, a shot if you are 30 years old or over. And it's going to be 16 and over starting April 6th.
Yeah, very exciting.
So that's really exciting. I got it because they're trying to reach underserved communities. Turns out I'm quite brown. and they were like, wow.
Found ya.
Oops. Amazing. So they opened up a center in Bed-Stuy, and not far from my house. And I walked in to do an appointment and it was empty. It was like completely empty. I was the only person making an appointment. And then they came upstairs and like, we've got 160 doses. So I got to get used. And I was like, amazing. Oh, well, I guess I'll just stick me with a needle, I guess. And that's what happened.
It's stories like that that make like the rest of us just loiter around hoping for that. But it's like the like Willy Wonka golden ticket. You just, not everybody's going to get one. But now everybody can get one. Yeah, I'm making
almost
an appointment. I think we're
getting,
weekend.
There, you guys. Herd immunity is tantalizingly close, which means everybody continue holding on for a little bit longer under these protocols and maybe don't get wild until like...
Please don't get wild yet.
Yeah, please don't get wild until we've hit a place where it's going to be a little bit safer for the people who can't receive vaccines because they're immune compromised, because they have other issues that prevent them from getting vaccinations because they might be allergic to materials inside the vaccines, and people who can at least create some level of herd immunity so that we were not passing on variants and other things to each other.
Yes.
So that's the key, guys, just a little bit longer, and then we can, I guess, get back to our miserable lives as they were before.
Yeah, that's true. It's like the fact that there are so many variants out there is like a good reason to keep social distancing. Like now is the time, because if we can, like the variants get stronger the more people they infect. So if we can like stop them from making us all sick as they're still bubbling up, like that's it. Then we're good for later in the year. Otherwise we're fucked for another year.
Also, breathing on each other is just so gross now. Yes, I agree. Like let's not get close to each other and like breathe on each other ever again.
Yeah.
I feel like this is just like, I'm just going to continue doing it anyway.
Totally.
I'm like,
no
okay,
way.
That's
yeah.
Gross.
Tomorrow's episode, we're going to talk a lot about like some things from the pandemic that we want to hold on to, some things that are good to go. And we're going to get into all of that fun stuff. Today, we're going to start with, so the first 2 days of the Derek Chauvin trial have seen very emotional testimony from witnesses on the scene that Memorial Day. A highlight yesterday, I don't know if it's a highlight, but it was definitely a really compelling testimony, was more from Donald Williams. He was a witness who was on the scene. He's also a martial artist. He witnessed the entire situation. The martial artist part is relevant because he knew what he was watching. The defense is using a lot of rationalization that Derek Chauvin was doing what he was trained to do. But here are several witnesses. One is a first responder, the 911 dispatcher, another the mixed martial artist, who are saying, no, you're not trained to do that. You're not trained to do that. Yesterday was really enraging to watch because the defense tried to paint Williams as an angry Black man so transparently to somehow show, I guess the objective is to show that him getting angry at the cops while they were killing someone disqualifies him from like disagreeing with the murder. But Williams knew exactly what was happening, of course. So let's listen to some of this really powerful exchange between he and one of the defense attorneys.
Do you recall saying, I dare you to touch me like that. I swear I'll slap the fuck out of both of you.
Yeah, I did. I meant it. Right.
So again, sir, it's fair to say that you grew angrier and angrier.
No, I grew professional and professional. I stayed in my body. You can't paint me out to be angry.
That's it. There was a bit more before that of a similar back and forth, just the defense attorney forcing Williams to repeat the words that he said that day, which of course, words do not kill people.
Yeah, I mean, but more than that, like to assume that a police officer armed and backed by the state feels threatened by a guy saying, if you touch me like that, I would fuck you up while he's murdering a person. Just like there's a whole bunch of logic that doesn't hold. It requires a lot of the rationalization, a lot of the processing around this. And I haven't watched because I unfortunately, like, I care about myself emotionally and I can't do that kind of lifting right now.
It's really, really tough.
It's like brutally hard. And I recently like watched a like small documentary about like Medgar Evers, and it's just like reminding me that like Black people are murdered in this country all the time just for trying to live and like participate in society. So it's just really hard to kind of process like there's this trial, yes, but like the entire frame of thinking requires white supremacy to make it make sense, because in theory, this should have been pled out. Like there's no reason to have a trial except that he thinks that there's, or that prosecutors feel like they have to hold one, or that Chauvin feels that he has to try to defend himself. Like there's really no defending it. It's a crime captured on video. Police are not supposed to murder civilians. It's just not supposed to happen. The whole purpose of police is to not do that. That's literally, in theory, why we have enforcement, law enforcement. But it's not. It's not in reality. In reality, it's a suppression tactic. It's a tool of white supremacy. It's law enforcement, regardless of the goodness or badness of any individual people within it, is not systemically designed to protect people. And I think fundamentally you get that same reasoning when you watch his defense, which basically rests on the idea that he had a right to murder, you know, George Floyd. It literally rests upon this idea that like there's nothing wrong. The system worked as it was supposed to. Mm-hmm. And you can't necessarily argue with that. I mean, like that reasoning is openly white supremacist, but it is the reasoning that built our modern law enforcement structure. So in one way, you can't indict Derek Chauvin for being the guy who believed it was true and carried it out. On the other hand, like it should indict our system. This should be the end of how we think about law enforcement. It's not. We continue to like suggest more money for cops. It's the worst idea I've ever heard, but
yeah. Yeah. I think the fact that you're right, their only defense, their unspoken defense is that they're getting to with their like actual verbal defense is that he should have had a right to kill him. There was no reason he shouldn't have done it in that moment. And you can tell that by the fact that they're constantly changing their defense. They're first saying like, oh no, he was kneeling down in a way that wasn't supposed to have that effect, or oh, he was stressed, or oh, he was just doing what he was trained to do. Oh, Floyd had ingested substances. So which is it then? Which is it then? No, you kneeled on his neck and he died. We watched it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really undeniable. I mean, it's not just that I haven't watched it and I haven't really engaged. Again, because like I think everybody's got certain lines and limits, and I don't feel like I need that to validate what's happened, but it's now stark enough that in order to make it not happen, you have to actively imbibe like certain white supremacist framing that suggests that Black people are inferior, they belong beneath white people, that their lives are not valuable or meaningful, that things like consuming substances or, you know, anything like that fundamentally removes our humanity. We have less humanity than white people, and it is easier to dispose of. I mean, there's just multiple levels of tropes in there, and it's important to kind of expose those and talk about what is fueling that thinking, because it's just different levels of dehumanization where like we wouldn't be having this argument if it was a white person, but it would never have happened to a white person. Like we keep having this thing where it's like, oh, well, more white people are killed by cops. It's like, well, more white people exist in the country. And as a ratio, like we're, you know, no one assumes that like in those situations that the whiteness of the person is doing the heavy lifting as to how they ended up in that situation. Whereas mm-hmm. Black people, it's almost entirely because we exist. It is a way to punish our existence. And this is pretty common and goes back really far. And, you know, it's never stopped. You know, it's foundational. So when I think about that, yeah.
As they've been saying, again, George Floyd is not on trial, so I don't want to harp on the things they're saying about him. But, you know, people will hear, oh, he had two Percocet on him. And I was joking with Sammy. I was like, who doesn't? And that's barely a joke, because do we fucking know the substance abuse crisis in this country? The amount of white people who have two Xanax on them, who have two Percocet on them, who have heroin on them, who look like nice white people. And were this to happen to them, I guess maybe it would come up in the defense, but this is two casual observers that are not educated enough. And even people that, I feel like the messages that were being in June when this happened and people were trying to educate themselves, the trial prevents, it's a totally new area. There's totally new topics that people need to be educating themselves and on guard about. And one of them is this like, character assassinations. I mean, they happened right after Floyd died, but they're more relevant here. And I wish I've seen more media challenging them more directly and saying that they're as a result of race, and like flip it around and imagine if this were a white person. Because the amount of times they have said he had two Percocet, he was drunk. It's like, look around. What are you talking about? Like that means nothing. That means it just, the amount of people I know, and I have a family member who was a heroin addict and went to jail so many times and is thriving now because he was never truly like held accountable legally. And when he was, our family was able to pay to have it dealt with. I mean, the amount of money it took to have it dealt with so that he could have a normal life. And there's just millions and millions and millions of kids who are like this, millions of people, millions of adults. And I just find it so personally disgusting that they would bring up something like that when we have an opioid crisis that is out of control. And just beyond that, the amount of casual drug use that goes on constantly that is in the top 40 that kids are dancing to on TikTok. And then in Minneapolis, you're going to go and say that he had two Percocet and he deserved to die. It's so I can't handle it.
Yeah, it's just a rationalization, as most things are what we call ex post facto rationalization. People do things that dehumanize people of color and then work backwards to find a way that it made sense. And like, if you look at our country's history, there's a lot, I mean, I'm going to toss out a word that everyone should look up, dryptomania, which is someone actually came up with a scientific term, scientific. This is like, yeah, that's when people say is it racist? Like, I'm just like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. But to describe why Black people would try to flee slavery, they suggested that it was a mental disorder wanting to be free. Because how could that otherwise explain it? Mm-hmm. If they're just regular humans who are being horribly oppressed, then, oh my God, then we're the bad guys. So I guess it's because they're crazy.
Are these the people the same, like, oh, they're happy, they're singing songs, people?
Yeah, but I mean, it all comes from the same place, right? Which is,
yeah,
we've done this thing and we need to rationalize why it's okay. And so we'll pathologize everything that it's like, this is the difference when bringing up like drug use between white people and black people, is that for white people, it becomes the individual white person. It becomes like, oh, what happened in their lives? What made them do this? It starts from an assumption that they had agency and they are people who are making decisions, but that they're not responsible for the negative decisions that they make, which is also something that's being wrapped up in this trial, right? On the other side, black people, anytime there's a mistake, it becomes, oh, that's because you're black, because you're not really human the way white people are, because you can't help yourself, because you are closer to being an animal than white people are, because you are uncivilized, because you are wild, because you are incapable of rational decision making. And so instead of saying, hey, what kind of factors could lead to this person making these kinds of decisions, or this actually seems like a relatively normal behavior, it becomes pathologized, like, oh my God, he had Percocet on him because black people can't get through their day without drugs. And I'm like, okay, well, drug use is the same. But the statistic, the truth doesn't matter because the pathology is the key.
I can't get through my day without drugs. Just kidding.
Who can get through their day without drugs? What is going on? It is 2021. Absolutely not. Okay. Right.
And you know what? I don't like the wine mommy culture either, but it's a reality. Like substance use and glorifying casual substance use is everywhere. I mean, I don't know why I'm so fixated on that, but it happens constantly. It happens every single time. And I just know that there were people watching that probably, you know, like you said, are like, well, yeah, I don't know. That sounds bad. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Why don't you go look in your daughter's purse?
Yeah. I mean, but that's different because their daughter is an individual because they know them because they see humanity. And it's really important to emphasize that they're going to do as much as they can to emphasize the humanity of Derek Chauvin, you know, and make clear that he's just a person. And not only is he a person, he is family. He has, I mean, all of these things, and suggest that like George Floyd was like this borderline animalistic brute, you know, and who couldn't have been controlled any other way than being murdered. Like, there's no way for that relationship to have ended with like, hey man, you know, take care, another day or whatever. I mean, we have white men who have murdered people or people who are perceived as white, who get the benefit of the doubt all the time, and can have literally murdered people, have weapons on them, are carrying weapons, we know that they've done this thing, and they get taken in sometimes uninjured, often sometimes completely fine. They're given food, they're supported, and yet they're going to argue, and they are arguing, that a black man who's unarmed and had two Percocet on him, which, by the way, if he were like really pathologized, I guess he would have more than two.
Right.
What is that? It's like a few hours worth of Percocet. That's not like for days. He's not like in a haze, whatever.
Yeah, totally. And the defense is saying, you know, appeared to be two Percocet. I can't verify exactly what was on him. The point is that it doesn't matter. And just the casual throwing out of that, like it was a huge indictment, was just insane. Another really difficult story for today we can't not address is that in New York City on Monday, there was a brutally violent attack on a 65-year-old Asian woman in New York City. A man has been arrested for the assault and for hate crimes after beating the Filipina woman while she was on her way to church. This happened outside of a luxury apartment building in Hell's Kitchen right by Times Square. And the security guards and other persons present in the building of the lobby did nothing. They watched and then they they seemed to close the door, even though the assailant was not approaching the building. It didn't look like there was any risk that the assailant was interested in entering the building. The assailant was screamed racist things at the woman and beat her. She's severely, severely injured, and she's in the hospital.
Yeah.
I think that on top of the Floyd trial has made this week really tough.
I mean, it's really important to continue highlighting that the racism against particularly East and South Asian people, Southeast Asian people has been like especially heightened since coronavirus happened. Has like completely altered our landscape, and specifically the racist taunting that was emphasized by the former president of the United States. I'm so mad. To have that kind of platform and then to say, oh, this is the fault of people who look like this, and to ascribe it to people's characteristics has emphasized a layer of violence. We can talk about lots of old tropes. So many tropes, you guys, white supremacy. It's just a vortex of terrible, terrible thinking and rationalizations. But, and it's important to recognize that, like, yeah, of course I understand that, like, assailants sometimes are Black and Latino. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, like, I'm saying, oh, it's really white people's fault. But when you construct a society in which everybody has to be at each other's throats because they're all trying to get one piece of this white supremacist pie, and the only way to do it is to tear the other person down, to suggest that they're less human so you can be more human, to build these structures that say these people who are foreign, you can tell they're not us, are a focus, and that xenophobia shapes that identity. That's part of white supremacy. That was not something that, like, we did on our own as marginalized groups, and it's not a set of thinking that we internally developed. It is something that society rewarded, that society promotes, and that society is shaped by white supremacy.
Yeah, and I've seen more in the response to this, like, stop Asian hate is so important to keep saying, of course, and it's also, I've also seen challenges of, you know, people want to bring, well, and no, we should end white supremacy. And I also mentioned that on a podcast, but then read further into how that dismisses the very specific issue happening with Asian Americans right now. But the stop Asian hate is very easy for people to share because it implies that not all of us can imagine committing a hateful, brutal, violent act against an Asian person or a person. So it's so easy for people to inherit that idea. Just stop Asian hate. That's fine. But the real issue is you have to stop messing up people's names, and you have to stop laughing at racist jokes, and you have to make better representation, and you have to be more transparent about salary with your Asian colleagues. Like, it's to stop Asian hate, you have to take all of those steps.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same set of structures that replicate things like white supremacy. These are all big parts of the same architecture. It's not to say, oh man, this is really a white supremacy issue and not an anti-Asian issue. It's very specifically an anti-Asian issue.
Elise has joined us for our last topic of the day. Tell us everything.
Hello, everyone. I am late for the podcast today because I was getting the Pfizer vaccine.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we got a Pfizer bitch. We got a Moderna bitch. I don't know what kind of bitch I'm going to be. I'll be any kind of bitch.
No, we have to collect them.
We do. We have to. Representation matters.
I got my vaccine at Walgreens. God bless turning 30 in quarantine and there was chaos at first, but ultimately very smoothly, and here's my vaccine card.
Amazing. You're here. You've come at the perfect time because we saved Matt Getz for you.
Ah, yes!
We saved Matt Getz for you. We just did some really, we talked about the trial and the hate crimes, and now we're going to talk about Matt Getz.
Great.
And this is also a very dark story. if true, and we'll discuss if we think it's true. So let's start with Matt Gaetz. So yesterday, the New York Times reported that three sources told them the Justice Department was investigating a possible sexual relationship with the Florida representative had with an underage girl, a girl who was 17, and whether he paid for her to travel with him. Such a move would constitute sex trafficking of a minor, punishable by federal charges. And this inquiry stems from a broader one looking at a friend of Getz's. It's a local official in Florida named Joel Greenberg, who just sounds like a Jeffrey Epstein light, like same shit. He's been indicted on sex trafficking, on exchanging money for sex with underage people. This dude even visited the White House.
Sounds like an awesome friend.
Oh yeah, he went to the White House with Getz and with Gates in 2019.
Amazing.
Old friends. So this investigation, it did start in the Trump administration. Getz denies the claim. He says he can be proven right. Let's listen to him expand on his claim on Tucker Carlson's show last night. Again, this is what Matt Getz says happened.
On March 16th, my father got a text message demanding a meeting wherein a person demanded $25 million in exchange for making horrible sex trafficking allegations against me go away. Our family was so troubled by that, we went to the local FBI. And the FBI and the Department of Justice were so concerned about this attempted extortion of a member of Congress that they asked my dad to wear a wire, which he did with the former Department of Justice official. Tonight, I am demanding that the Department of Justice and the FBI release the audio recordings that were made under their supervision and at their direction, which will prove my innocence and that will show that these allegations aren't true. They're merely intended to try to bleed my family out of money. And this former Department of Justice official tomorrow was supposed to be contacted by my father so that specific instructions could be given regarding the wiring of $4.5 million as a down payment on this bribe. I don't think it's a coincidence that tonight, somehow, the New York Times is leaking this information, smearing me, and ruining the investigation that would likely result in one of the former colleagues of the current DOJ being brought to justice for trying to extort me and my family.
So a couple of obvious questions that come to mind, and again, just to restate, this just happened. Don't have any other information beyond what we've already said.
Eight minutes. I'm going to tell you what else happens in this clip. And this clip is like, Tucker, you know how it is to be falsely accused. You were once. And then Tucker Carlson was like, yeah, but it was like a viewer who accused me 20 years ago who was found to have like some mental instability. And then Getz is like, you know, remember when we went to dinner together in Florida with my friend, the girl, and Tucker Carlson goes, I don't know what you're talking about. And then when it ends, he goes, that was the weirdest interview I've ever conducted. Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, it's pretty bad when you're watching an interview and you're like Tucker Carlson is speaking for you in the interview. Like, that's not good. And like when he's the reasonable person, that's a very bad situation. And it is really funny to watch him run as far as he can from the buddy shit that Matt Gaetz is trying to do in this interview. He's like, yeah, I don't think we ever had dinner, man. I don't know what you're talking about.
Mark Gaetz, is it?
Yeah, Rick Mark Gaetz. I'm sorry.
I've had dinner with Rick Gaetz, but not Mark Gaetz. I mean, this is wild. If he has made up a very elaborate story. I do not think the Times, I read the bylines on this. I do not think the Times would publish a report like this that it did not know was at least partially true. What do we think?
I mean, it seems like there is an investigation, whether that we need to know a lot more about what that investigation entails, but there's something very Brett Kavanaugh-y about his response to just be like, my daddy is wearing a wire. Everyone's being mean to my daddy. And like there's something very like crying about your calendars to me about this.
Right.
Like the lady doth protest too much.
Right. The script was very, very meticulous.
No, it's also extremely specific in very weird ways to like jump to accusations that haven't actually been made yet.
Sure.
So where he's like, I never did Q, well, Q. I never did like A, B, C. And they're like, this entire discussion is about X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
It's about this totally different, like maybe the specific person, but you're under like this entire broad thing. Oh, you're being extorted for like $25 million.
I also didn't realize that Matt and his family had money like that.
I mean, most members of Congress are worth more than we immediately would think. Yeah. It's a very millionaires club.
Yeah. The richest member of the Senate, do you guys know who it is? This is like my favorite fact. It's
I
Mark
know it
Warner.
Used to be it Kelly Lomley. Lessler. Oh, but it's Mark Warner.
It's fucking Mark Warner, who wow, like quite is so wealthy. And remember last year he like went viral because he couldn't make a tuna salad sandwich? Like, you're eating tuna salad sandwich on white bread and you're worth like $200 million.
That's exactly why he can't
good
make
point.
A sandwich. When yeah. has he ever, this is the first time he was like, oh my God, I'm in my kitchen. I usually there are chefs here.
Yes. Mark Warner is a Democrat from Virginia who we love. So good yes. for Mark.
This is a digression, but when I worked at a summer camp one summer, there was a kid there who was a part of the Saudi royal family. It was one of the campers. And my friend was his counselor on his floor. And one day he came in and he realized that this kid had not unpacked his bag because he like did not know how because someone else had packed it for him and he had never unpacked a bag or put a drawer together or anything. So my friend had to help him unpack his bag. And then he also tried to... He also tried to bring $1,500 in cash to the mall. We went on a trip to the mall with all the eighth graders and he came up to my friend and was like, is this enough money for the mall, Paul? And Paul was like, what? Oh my God.
Yeah.
Don't bring that to the mall.
Yeah. This Matt Gaetz definitely sounds like somebody who's had to make up an elaborate excuse before involving his father and their riches. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very, very serious allegation and, he has this defense and I feel weird saying anything else. I mean, it's hard to imagine I guess you can kind of imagine in like a crazy TV show, the New York Times, like maybe those sources would not have known about another investigation, but I think that the reporters, I don't know, this would be, a devastating error on behalf of
yeah. the it would be very, very bad if they published it and it wasn't true. Not that, that's never happened. Like that,
something
has,
like this would be pretty unprecedented.
Yeah. They do a lot of checking, and there is like a crossover with the legal department before they like release something like United States congressman being investigated for sex trafficking a 17-year-old girl.
Yeah,
that feels very specific, and it feels like something. Yeah. Definitely would have to check in on before you do that.
Yes.
And then it's really disturbing. Can we talk about for a second the fact that a huge chunk of the defenses of Gaetz, including his own, is that 17 is the age of consent in multiple states. That's not an excuse.
Right.
In any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Fuck, teenagers are teenagers. That's just my general take.
Right.
Or maybe you could argue 20, but I find myself like thinking about being 20 years old and being interested in teenagers and being like, no, that wasn't my energy. It was definitely.
No, imagine if a guy, how old is Matt Gaetz? He's like maybe a little older than us. And we know people in their late 30s. Like we're almost there.
No, if I would not be pleased.
No, if my friend.
It's a yeah. little bit Woody Allen. It's a little.
A wee bit.
It's
I'd say a smidge.
Jerry Seinfeld. It's probably like I'm trying to figure out what universe.
I mean, it would be more Woody Allen if he was dating Nestor.
It would maybe it's a friend of Nestor's.
I'm sorry, it's true.
It's
Woody
true.
Allen is dating his adopted daughter.
It's
he's married
so
to her.
Disturbing.
That will be his excuse. He's going to think that's going to legitimize it. I don't know. I'm very curious to see where this story is going. That's our show. Stick around for a conversation I had with Jen Klein. She co-chairs the White House Gender Policy Council. And we talked about on the last day of this godforsaken Women's History Month, we talked about what it really means, the stat that we have fallen 30 years behind in workforce participation. What does that mean? Does that mean it's going to take 30 years to catch back up? What do we do with this moment where women are angry and realizing how
fucked up expectations for us have been for a long time. And so she's sort of, we talked about how to really optimize this opportunity. So stick around for that. Hi, everyone. It is Amanda here. And today I'm back with Jennifer Klein. She's the co-chair of the White House Gender Policy Council. And she's here to chat with us at the end of Women's History Month about the pandemic's impact on women and how we can maybe undo some of the damage. Welcome, Jennifer. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am particularly aggrieved that this is like our second Women's History Month in quarantine. It was last year, we're like midway through, they sent us home, and now we've had a whole another March in quarantine, but not without, there's been a lot of activity going on.
That is for sure. And I think that this Women's History Month, a year into COVID, it's a particularly important time to both recognize the contributions that women have made throughout history, which is obviously one important part of the month, but also to really focus attention on the women that we don't always talk about. You know, a year into COVID, women are still contending with not only a public health crisis, but also an economic crisis. And on top of those challenges, a caregiving crisis. Mm-hmm. The pandemic has exacerbated barriers that have held women back, especially women of color, for years and made things more visible, but also worse, forcing many to leave the workforce, manage virtual schooling, and absorb additional caregiving responsibilities for their children, for sick and aging relatives, et cetera. And also, you know, again, I will never use the word silver lining, but one thing that we have seen because of the pandemic is a little bit more of recognition of the women who have been on the front lines in the response to COVID. These are the essential workers, and this Women's History Month, I think it is past time, but also a great time to recognize the work that these essential workers have been doing, keeping our economy, our communities, and our families going. Those are the grocery workers, the health aides, the nursing staff, really at every level, public health professionals, childcare workers, teachers, who literally have been the backbone for decades and of not only of our economy, but also of our communities. And again, just to circle back to Women's History Month, it's time to recognize their contributions as well.
Yeah. I've had that sense too, that it does really feel like a good opportunity now that this crisis has exposed a lot of things that women have been very familiar with for a long time, to expose them more directly and actually act on them, which the administration has already done through the American Rescue Plan. So you just talked about, and we've been talking about on the show all month, really all year, about this disproportionate impact that the pandemic has had on women. As you mentioned, from job loss to childcare challenges to leaving the workforce altogether to care for children, if people had that option with more income. And a lot of women didn't really have a financial safety net, but were forced to make that choice anyway. So how does the immediate response in the provisions in the American Rescue Plan address these issues is sort of my first question. And secondly, how will those provisions sort of help buoy women as we emerge from this crisis a little bit longer term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, before I jump into the American Rescue Plan, I'd just also add that, you know, you've pointed out and you have been over the course of this month, as you just mentioned, the job losses that have literally erased 30 years of progress that women have made in the labor force. The other thing, you know, we marked Equal Pay Day, or one of the equal pay days this month. And the other thing to recognize is that in addition to the women who've literally left the workforce, one of the things that we pointed out on Equal Pay Day, and it bears repeating, is that, you know, part of the pay gap is literal discrimination. So, you know, a woman doing the same job as a man being paid less. But part of that are these other factors, which, again, we're seeing in the pandemic. You know, number one, additional caregiving responsibilities, which either take women out of the workforce intermittently or sometimes permanently. And also, you know, what I talked about earlier about essential workers is this sort of notion of occupational segregation. You know, women have historically been overrepresented in fields where they get paid less. Many of the ones I mentioned earlier. And again, that is contributing to the economic distress. So then to get to the question you asked about the American Rescue Plan, I mean, you know, I think there is so much that is in there that is critical to helping women and their families get through this pandemic. Everything from literally getting vaccines in arms and kids back to school, and then the very real and very immediate economic support that it provides. So it as increases the child tax credit from $2,000 per child to $3,000 per child, $3,600 for a child under six, and actually makes 17-year-olds qualifying children for the year. And that means that a typical family of four with two young kids will receive an additional $3,200 in assistance. And that benefits 66 million children. Wow. The ARP also increases the earned income tax credit for 17 million workers by as much as $1,000. And that benefits the cashiers, food preparers, and servers, and home health aides that I mentioned earlier, those frontline workers who are helping communities get through the crisis. It expands childcare assistance and helps those hard hit childcare providers who are disproportionately women of color cover their costs. It's actually through these the childcare tax credits to cover the cost of childcare. It is the single biggest investment in childcare since World War II. Awesome. And then it also, the ARP also gives families an additional tax credit to help cut childcare costs. Finally, yeah. As you can hear, I can go on and on, but it also provides $130 billion to help schools serve all students and get them back to school safely, which is, as we all heard, was President Biden's goal to do within his first 100 days of his administration, and obviously has beat that goal. And, you know, together, these historic actions will rescue our economy and support women and families, literally cut child poverty in half.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, as you've been talking, it's so clear that these issues that disproportionately impact women, all of these intersections, they compound, and the plan really addresses that and provide support in all of those areas. What considerations were made to ensure the American Rescue Plan would have an equitable impact on all women? You spoke before about how this pandemic has had a disproportionate impact on women of color.
I think literally every one of those policies that I just ran through, deep consideration was made not only to gender gaps, but also racial gaps. And sort of a focus on racial equity as well as gender equity. And that's why these particular policies were chosen. This is why this investment was made. You know, I think what we, you know, as we talked about earlier, what we have seen is really something that has long existed, which is, you know, not only the gender disparities, but also disparities based on race and really other forms of discrimination, and if not literal discrimination, barriers that have been placed on people who've been, you know, the most marginalized. And so what this plan does is focus investment and attention on really all of those communities.
Awesome. You mentioned that women's labor force participation has now reached its lowest point in more than 30 years. I see this statistic a lot. I cite it a lot. It's really alarming, but I don't really know how to wrap my head around it. Does this mean we have 30 years of ground to make up again, or can we close those gaps more efficiently as we recover from the pandemic and implement policies that will make us stronger? What does that number, that 30 years number, really mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, you and I were talking about this earlier. I think the notion that, again, we both carefully avoided the use of the word opportunity. But yeah. I think the fact that that this has really, this pandemic, and as I said at the outset, you know, the economic crisis that followed and the caregiving crisis that followed has laid bare what has long existed. It made it worse, but that doesn't mean it's going to take 30 years to make it better. But Great. You know what you'll see, both through the American Rescue Plan and, you know, the additional investments to build back this economy better, because what we don't need is to go back to the economy that existed before. We need a better economy, an economy that works for everybody. You're going to see over the course of the next few weeks the president making additional announcements and investments, calling for additional investments, to really get at these longstanding deep issues of inequity. And if we can do that, if as a country we see what is needed and we can, you know, get there, then I think, you know, we will end up in a better place. We will end up with an economy that actually works for people, that invests in our families, that gives people an equal shot. I mean, I think that is what we really need to do, is level the playing field so that people have an equal shot without these barriers placed in front of them at every turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, my last question, you mentioned straight up gender discrimination as well as a concern that the administration wants to address. What else when it comes to this can we expect the White House to prioritize in the coming year? Specifically, I've seen some activity and some encouragement for Congress to act on the Paycheck Fairness Act.
Yeah, I would say that's number one on the agenda, is to do exactly that, enact the Paycheck Fairness Act. And the president would love to sign that piece of legislation. So he spoke about it on Equal Pay Day, and you will hear him talking about it in the future. And then I think there are some executive actions that we can take that we are considering right now. You know, one of the key issues to address the pay gap is transparency. What does that mean? That means that if you don't know what your problem is, you can't solve your problem. And that, you know, literally means that workers can't, in many cases, actually ask about a colleague's salary or talk about it with their employer. And, you know, lifting that veil of secrecy is one step toward actually getting to pay equity. There's also, you know, sort of a broader effort at transparency that, you know, would either encourage or require employers to disclose their pay gaps, their median pay gaps over the, you know, their entire workforce. And what we've seen when companies do that is that, again, when they know they have a problem, they address it. And so, you know, again, we'll be working toward increasing transparency to really get immediately to the pay gap.
Yeah, lots of exciting things. Thank you so much for your time, Jennifer. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman, and this is the Betches Sub Podcast.
The Betches Sub Podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Jorge Morales Pico, and Sean Kilby. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Be sure to follow at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, and send us your emails to suppod@betches.com.
Betches.